Well, welcome to week number 41. This is the podcast that is based upon the newsletter for Rexlam, written by Kirby Lakranji and by Dawn Riddler. If you want to know more about this newsletter, you can pick it up, you can read it. We reference that in this podcast, and there's lots and lots of information in there other than the things that we chat about. Dawn, for the week, the S&P 500 slightly up at 45 basis points. NASDAQ is down 0.18%. Year to date, the S&P 500 up 12.7%, NASDAQ up 28.1%. That's obviously that tech-heavy, large five companies that have really drifted, made sure that the NASDAQ drifted higher, and so also with the S&P 500. The equally weighted S&P 500 hasn't done nearly as well as what the market cap weighted S&P 500 has done this year, just to show the impact of the actual markets. For the week, the Euro Stoxx 22 is down 0.22%. For the month so far, or shall I just say for the rolling month, down 3.7%. And then across in Asia for the week, the Nikkei is actually up 4.18%. For the rolling month, down 3.7%. Across in the bond world, US 2-year yields now at 5.05%, US 10-year yields at 4.64%. And US 20 years at 4.98. Now, Dawn, what I find quite interesting, and, you know, we talk about markets on a weekly basis. You know, we watch them daily. We talk about them on a weekly basis. But it's almost like you're watching paint dry. You know, in some days, everything happens quickly. And then there's long spurts of time where very, very little happens actually in markets. And it's all about kind of the cementing of long-term trends that slowly take hold. But Dawn, the inversion in the yield curve, which we actually speak about quite a bit in this newsletter this week, the inversion between the 10 and 1 year. So that's now, if I take 1 year yields and 10 year yields and I compare those two, that inversion is now at minus 0.78%. And if you go back to July of this year, that inversion was almost at minus 1.6%. So actually on a 6-month basis, the inversion has actually now at its least amount than what it has been for 6 months. And that just shows you how this yield curve is trying to kind of readjust itself, how the happenings in the world slowly are trying to readjust this yield curve. It'll be interesting to see what happens to this in time. But certainly the inversion has gone from minus 1.6% to kind of 0.78% where we are at this stage.
I think one of the interesting things that I've read about a lot recently is that the Americans, and particularly the retirees and those looking for fixed income, have cottoned on to the idea that they can get a real yield of 4.5, 4.75, but, you know, as high as 5% on their income, and don't have to rely on dividends, which is where they've been relying on for a long time. And one of the other things that I talk about, and, you know, just sort of changing the subject slightly, but still onto to bonds and long-term trends, is the fact that pension funds, government pension funds across the world, are in a whole bunch of trouble. And it is only getting worse. There are fewer and fewer entrants into the job market, not because jobs aren't there, but because there are just fewer people at the end of the day. And I have always likened it a little bit to a Ponzi scheme, where the governments have always relied on the fact that you've got all these new youngsters coming into the market, new taxpayers that can fund this pension pot. And that is no longer the case. And how are they going to fund this going forward? You know, the deficit that is accumulating in those long-term pension funds should worry everybody. Well, not necessarily South Africans. I mean, most of us taxpaying South Africans look after our own pensions. We don't rely on the government pension. But certainly, if you're in Europe or if you're in America or if you're in Canada, you should be worried.
Mm. So, Dawn, there's quite a nice visual that I put into the piece that I write for the newsletter this week, and it shows the effective federal funds rate, now that's interest rates in America, going back to 1956. So it's a kind of a long-term look at how interest rates have actually evolved and moved in the United States. Now, it's something which I reference. It's something which other great investors in the world have been referencing of late. Then there's some truth in the following synopsis. In 1980, interest rates in America was running at above 17.5%. Remember, this is on the back end of the oil embargo. There was a squeeze in oil. America had to get involved. This is where OPEC really got traction and the whole idea around trying to create unity around the oil price. And then slowly but certainly, the world went into a interest rate spiral downward. So in 1980, interest rates were up at about 17, 18, 19%. Let's call it somewhere there. And they really ended off their downward spiral back in, call it the late 2020. So call it 2020, 2021, 2020, where interest rates were sitting at 0.5%. And you could see how this has created this massive influx of liquidity and just of money back into the system because the cost of capital has slowly, slowly dwindled over those many, many, many years. And as the cost of capital has dwindled, so it has provided impetus to companies not only to borrow more, but potentially to also grow more, predominantly because you had individuals that were able to afford more from a ticket price perspective. So you go to the stores and suddenly you find that you've got more money in your pocket because rates have come down. It's not because you've done a brilliant job at work. You might have, but it's not necessarily because of your own efforts. It's the government and the economy helping you along. That has now abruptly changed. So we're kind of living in this world at the moment where we're moving from what we call a monetary base to something that is called a fiscal base. And the last time around the world was in a fiscal base was back in the 1930s. You know, that whole period in the world economy that led to the advent of the Second World War. You know, we're talking about nationalism. We're talking about it's not about open borders and the ability to be able to take in the world and globalization. It's about what's mine is mine and what is yours, and hopefully I can take some of yours. And this move to a fiscal base goes hand and parcel, not only because of political agendas, but because a lot of what's happening in economics is driving that fiscal methodology. So governments, as you've rightly pointed out, and you write about it in the newsletter this week as well, governments are becoming more and more indebted across the world. South Africa is no exception. The US is a leader in that space. Japan has been leading in that space for many, many years. And as these debt piles continue to build and build and build over time, there has to be a way to deal with these things. You have to pay the interest bill on this. Higher rates obviously is not great for that because you're reissuing debt at higher and higher rates all the time. So you have to try and push rates lower. But pushing rates lower at this stage of the juncture for America is quite disadvantageous because they're trying to get inflation under control. So it's a bit like half a dozen of one and dozen of the other. You're not quite sure where to go. And then you've got this major shift from a monetary base into a fiscal base. And we're not quite certain what those outcomes are going to look like in a decade from now, and even just 2, 3, 4 years out from today.
I think there's very little doubt that the American consumer, and I should think the British consumer and the European consumer are not far behind, is that they have run out of credit. And so they are now going to be forced to live within their means, as it were, instead of funding the gap in the cost of living with credit. Stores like Walmart and Target are already starting to see the tightening. And really, they're at the lower end of the market. You know, obviously luxury behaves completely differently. But when it comes to necessities, there was a very interesting article that I saw recently with the CEO of Walmart who said that there's a distinct trend of consumers just buying essentials and not buying even the sort of semi-luxuries or the nice to haves. They're really just catering to the need to have. So things like you're going to see a decrease in spending on things like clothing, for example, is probably one area where you're going to see a downgrade in that, maybe some cosmetics and things like that. And, you know, sort of keeping food on the table starts to become much more important. And of course, a roof over your head. And rentals are just insane. And, you know, they, because of the, in some respects, because of the increase in price of houses over the last, certainly certain over the last 5 years, but the trend goes back way before that. And unfortunately, the trend of people like hedge funds getting involved in rental properties, and they're not very nice, gentle landlords. And so rentals have gone through the roof. And the number of American consumers that are having to just hold down two jobs just to keep the heads above water is just unsustainable.
That has got to do with that interest rate cycle. So when rates are up at 18% in 1980, property is unaffordable because nobody can afford to borrow money to buy property unless you're very wealthy and you're just buying it outright. So property markets become muted. And then slowly, over decades, as rates continue to drop and drop and drop and drop, what happens to property prices? They continue to escalate because people are able to borrow at levels, and then their repayments just become less and less because rates are dropping on a continuous basis. And over decades, you've got this property prices that continue to escalate and they become part of the discourse. Your child comes of age and they have to purchase a home. You say, well, listen, property always goes up. You don't have to worry about it. Just buy property. And then some property entrepreneurs decide, well, listen, because rates continuously are falling, I don't just buy one, I buy two, three, four, five, six potential properties, you know? And as this happens, it becomes almost a self-fulfilling prophecy. Property prices continue to escalate as rates continue to drop. And at some point down the line, and we are at that point today, where property becomes unaffordable. So if you look across the Western world, you look at the UK, you look at Canada, and you look at America, property is unaffordable. It is very, very, very expensive. What do kids do? Well, they live at home because what other option have they really got? Or they try their level best to try and get on their feet by holding, as you said, Dawn, two jobs in order to get part of the rental pool. But if you are a property owner today, and especially in the residential world, and rates stay up at the 5% level where we are at the moment, the housing market is slowly going to slide backwards. It might not be a 20, 30% quick drawdown in property prices, but you might find that property prices just slide over time and this interest in property as an asset class starts waning. And as it wanes, more and more people pull their money out the market, and then it becomes a bear market in the property world. That's this tightrope that the Federal Reserve is finding itself in. They know that from a fiscal perspective, they've got large challenges. They've got baby boomers that have retired. They need to make sure that a lot of those folk are looked after. They need to make sure that they create back into the infrastructure just so that they can make sure cities and just the smooth work of the states amongst themselves continue to happen. And if that doesn't happen, and if they stop doing it, then that becomes very, very unpopular from a political perspective. So Ray Dalio makes a point that it's the quantity of money that's been made available in the system, with obviously the huge impetus during the COVID crisis. And the question now is, are they going to be paying it back with printed money or earned money? The one is an easier way out, but has much more implications, because if you're just going to continue to print money to pay back money, then it's just more of the vicious circle. If you're going to do it with earned money, that's a very hard road to walk. And I don't know if public mindset is there yet from a global perspective, Dawn. It might get there, especially when countries have to get behind a single flag and do something for the country. A bit like what's happening in Israel right now. All the Israelis are behind the Israeli flag and they're going to be doing something for the country. The Gaza Strip is the enemy. And you could see how the country has rallied around it. Now, that rallying call, you're not seeing in the West at this stage, anywhere else. That doesn't exist. Might take a crisis, you might find it.
You know, the thing is, I think the added thing that you certainly get in America, and really not so much anywhere else, is this absolute polarity between the Republicans and the Democrats, right?
Yes.
Literally, there's very little middle ground. You're either on one side or you're on the other. There's very little room for even an independent in this sort of situation. It's almost divided 50-50. And the last thing that either party want is to themselves unpopular coming into a presidential election. So, I mean, in reality, the Democrats are not going to even touch this hot potato until
No.
October next year, right? Then they might have 4 years to make themselves unpopular, Biden to make himself unpopular, the House to make themselves unpopular, and 4 years might be good enough to do things like raise taxes, which will have to be done, particularly and raising, instituting maybe things like the wealth tax. Coming back to that wealth tax, I've always kind of thought from a South African perspective, this wealth tax can never really work. I still think that in the South African instance. But I was looking at the sort of welfare states and the role of benefits in some of these countries. And I was looking at Norway and I sort of went down a little bit of a rabbit hole in terms of what are the tax rates and what is wealth tax and how do they make it work? I didn't know what Norway's tax rate was until I started to, look it up and sort of see what it's like. And I was very surprised to find out that it's a flat 22%. A flat. It doesn't matter if you earn 10 rand or you earn, R1 million a month. It doesn't matter. It's 22%, which is one thing. But one of the differentials is that they have wealth tax. And the wealth tax, if there's some state and there's some government ones that are imposed, but it works out at about 1.1% of assets at the highest bracket per annum. So it basically, takes 100 years for you to pay 100% of it at the end of the day. But in conjunction with that, they don't charge estate duty. And you'll
Yes.
find this that in countries that impose a wealth tax, Netherlands also does, France is looking at, France has it in some way, shape, or form, but France is, law unto itself. In conjunction with having a wealth tax, then estate duty is done away with. Now, as you know, estate duty here in South Africa is 20%. In the States, it's 40%. In the UK, it's 40%, with some allowances here and there. But it's quite interesting to see how they sort of come up with this and make it more equitable in many respects. Which brings me to another sort of a rabbit hole that I went down is what about beneficial ownership of trusts? Because obviously, the first thing that somebody wealthy does is to protect themselves from the tax man by placing their assets into a trust. Now, I mean, here in South Africa, if you've got a trust or you read about trusts, you'll know that the Davis Commission has been on a mission for a good 7 or 8 years, constantly making trusts less
Yes.
and less of a viable solution for the wealthy. And with the change from the SARS perspective, the taxation of South African residents when they're wanting to take money outside of the country, not so much the taxation, but the hoops that they have to run through. And one of the hoops that the new hoops that have only been in place since March this year is that if you want to take more than 10 million rand per annum out of the
Right.
country, you have to declare beneficial ownership of all trusts here or offshore.
Sure.
And that is just the thin edge of the wedge when it comes to trusts. Even countries like Norway, they're now starting to say it's not just your wealth that you've got, but beneficial ownership of trusts. And I do put a link in the newsletter because it's obviously a really quite a complicated topic to try and explain in a couple of minutes. But if you're interested in it, please go to that link. And obviously, you can call me if you want to talk about your trust in any more detail.
Yeah, so and again, Dawn, that just shows you just kind of the space that we've been in for the last couple of decades. If you're as a country, you've got a tax base, and if your tax base is incrementally growing by 2-3% every year, and you've got new taxpayers joining the system, and incrementally over time, a lot of those people slowly, slowly increase their wages over time, you as a tax authority benefit. You as a country benefit, and everybody benefits. But when you're sitting with a lopsided demographic pool where a lot of these individuals are now retiring and you've got less and less people working, your tax base is slowly dwindling. And as your tax base dwindles, you need to start looking for tax revenues. Now, how you do that? Well, firstly, you milk the cow that you've got, and then you try and milk it some more. You kind of say, well, look, and this is where the trust issue comes in right across the world. If you are a beneficial owner or you're a beneficiary of a trust, you need to declare it. Where is it coming from? How much is it? And why are you getting it? And what is the link to it? Whereas 20, 30 years ago, probably countries just kind of went, well, listen, it's a lot more lucrative for us just to, the tax base is growing by 2-3% a year. Forget about that. It's not that important. But today it's become more important. And that's, I think, just, from an advisory perspective, from an asset management perspective, if we're moving into this fiscal base, away from this monetary base, you might find that the traditional 60-40 portfolio, 60% in equities and 40% in bonds, just don't work that well. Most of the textbooks that we've written and we understand and that most people have been taught with, which is modern portfolio theory and the likes, most of those textbooks were written in the latter part of the 20th century. That was a world that had monetary base at its core thinking. If one has to understand fiscal base, you've got to go back to Keynes. You've got to go back to John Maynard Keynes, We're going back now to the 1930s. You've got to go understand how those worlds operated. And suddenly you've got to start thinking differently about the world. And I mean, those are things I think that most asset managers and just quite frankly, advisors need to start thinking about as we move into this new phase of the world. Does this end up in a full-scale global war? That the chances are very good that that's not going to happen. We might just be seeing all this low-level skirmishes happening across the world as new lines get divided and people just find themselves in place, you know, just in new trading blocks with new ways of doing it. And the cost of doing so might just be more expensive. But this is all kind of in the future. And this is stuff that we need to look at on a daily basis and try and understand how that influences investment strategy.
Toby, I think looking at demographics, and I find it really interesting, and you and I talk about it a lot, particularly when it comes to China, because I mean, China has been the engine of growth. It has been the savior of a lot of our portfolios for over a decade as it was growing at sort of 10, 11, 12% plus when nobody else was. But that's no longer the case. And to see that this is now really starting to show in their census figures, that one child policy, although it was abolished in 2015, the mindset is still there. So you can't suddenly say to, you know, an entire 1 billion population, okay, look, sorry, you know, go back to having six children. You know, they're more educated. They've seen the benefit of not having to spend a lot of money on all these different children, but be able to focus on one or maybe two children and give them the best education that they need. So, you know, that it can't be undone just because they want it undone. I think to all intents and purposes, China's had its day in many respects.
And I think not a lot of commentators are talking about that door. You know, demographically, this country's window of opportunity is today. If you look at the extrapolations, even a decade out, that demographic windfall is just dwindling at a rapid rate because of the one-child policy. So technologically, just to try and just trying to make the country work just at a very, very basic level, you need the people, especially a country the size of China. And a lot of people aren't factoring this in. You know, it's very difficult to motivate citizens in a country like China that you should be fighting potentially a world war if you know that just from a demographic perspective, things are dwindling. It's not like you have this healthy base that you're working from where everybody can get behind a national ideology. It becomes more and more difficult. So I think the China-America issue will continue to play itself out. Yes, one hopes that it doesn't get into much more of a conflict situation. But both sides, especially the Chinese, know that this will cost them a ton of money. And is a human will there? I don't know if the human will is there. And quite frankly, the opportunity is now. If it doesn't happen now, they're going to be in trouble. Well, this is week number 41. This is the podcast based upon our newsletter. Thank you for listening to another week of the newsletter. We urge you to go across the newsletter, go and read it. There's lots more information there. Or reach out and have a chat to us. This is Kirby and Dawn. Thanks for listening.